This is Vatican Radio. I'm Tracy McClure. We present Jill Bevilacqua's program, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Let's listen.
Jesus spoke this parable addressed to those who believed in their own self-righteousness, while holding everyone else in contempt. Two men went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, with head unbowed, prayed in this fashion: I give you thanks, O God, that I am not like the rest of men, grasping, crooked, adulterous, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week, I pay tithes on all I possess. The other man, however, kept his distance, not even daring to raise his eyes to heaven. All he did was beat his breast and say, O God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Believe me, this man went home from the temple justified, but the other did not. For everyone who exalts himself shall be humbled, while he who humbles himself shall be exalted.
In the year 63 BC, the Roman general Pompey besieged and captured Jerusalem. The very same day he entered the city as conqueror, Pompey also entered its most sacred place, the temple. Not to pray, for he was no Jew, but for sheer curiosity. He had heard much of this building, conceived by David, built by Solomon, sacked, destroyed, and rebuilt again and again. Who and what did this people of Israel adore? He was determined to find out. And at last, here was the opportunity to do so. This is how Piero Bargellini tells it in his Story of the Gospels.
He went in, sword in hand, fearing perhaps the ambush of some monster. Cautiously he went forward until he reached the pentagonal door, beyond which only the high priest was allowed to go, and that only once a year. He slit the veil with his sword and peered into the darkness. Maybe he thought he would see a fearful idol, one of those bestial shapes dear to the imagination of the ancient peoples of the East. But he saw nothing of the sort. In the Greco-Roman temples, the divinity was represented by beautiful statues of gilded bronze, or of painted marble, or of ivory and gold. But in the Holy of Holies of the Temple of Jerusalem, the Roman soldier saw no sculptured idol richly adorned. That room without windows, immersed in darkness, was empty. It was inhabited only by the mystery of a God who was not material, but spiritual and transcendent. It was the mystery of him who is, Lord of souls, animator of the spirit, the mystery of the one true God, invisible, immaterial, whom the people of Israel brought into the history of the world and the destiny of mankind.
This sacred place, this temple, is where our Lord sets the scene of the parable he recounts in today's Gospel. Although it was Solomon who built the first temple, in the 10th century BC, it was with the works of Herod the Great, inaugurated 4 years before our Lord was born, that it is said to have reached the peak of its magnificence. While even the smallest village had its synagogue, there was only one temple, and for Jews it was God's own house, the only place where the offering of sacrifice was allowed. Pagans were not permitted even into the temple area, on pain of death. Into this sacred place then, or rather up to it, for the temple was on a hill, two men went to pray, a Pharisee and a tax collector. The very first time we come across the Pharisees in the New Testament is in the 3rd chapter of St. Matthew's Gospel, when John the Baptist sees a group of them coming for baptism together with Sadducees, and he calls them a brood of vipers. Nor does our Lord mince his words when he speaks of whited sepulchres, which outwardly appear to men beautiful, but within are full of dead men's bones and every kind of corruption. To the undiscerning, they seemed like good, honest men, but inside were full of hypocrisy. And hypocrisy is probably the characteristic we most associate with Pharisees. To call someone a Pharisee, I read somewhere, is to consider that person an unctuous hypocrite. A sublime personification of such a person is the principal character in Molière's play Tartuffe. The dramatist declares elsewhere that it's the business of comedy to reflect the faults and follies of the age, and that while there is, among others he lists, hypocrisy in the world, he will never run short of material. When Tartuffe first appears on stage, he is ostentatiously carrying a hair shirt and a scourge while pretending to be deeply absorbed in a book. He has wormed himself into the household of a rich merchant, Monsieur Orgon, who has been totally taken in by Tartuffe's apparent sanctity.
If you could have seen him as I first saw him, every Sunday he would come to the church and, with such humility, kneel down just in front of me. And by the very fervour of his praying, in some strange way, would draw the attention of the whole congregation upon himself. And when I left the church, he would follow. And in the great porchway, as I went out into the open air, he would always be there, to offer me a few drops of the holy water. That's all he did. And although his whole manner was so humble, so self-effacing, yet it was impossible not to notice him, not to be impressed. And when I learned that he was a pauper through his manservant, I began giving him a few trifling sums of money. And always, would you believe it, he wanted to give me back part of it. "It's too much," he would say, "too much. I don't deserve such generosity." Of course, I refused to take it back. And then and there, before my very eyes, he'd distribute it among the poor.
Orgon's listener on this occasion is his brother-in-law, who asks incredulously if the man had given all the money to the poor.
"No, no, no. That would have been too insensitive. No, the part that I had refused to take back."
Orgon's brother-in-law tries to open his eyes, warning him that such a heavy cloak of virtue is sometimes worn to conceal the vices beneath it. But his words fall on deaf ears. It's not until the end of the play that Tartuffe is unmasked, and Orgon realizes and admits that he has been led by the nose. But hypocrites are consummate actors, and many are fooled by them. Indeed, Milton writes in Paradise Lost,
"For neither man nor angel can discern hypocrisy, the only evil that walks invisible, except to God alone."
In the 19th century, Edward Bouverie Pusey, friend of John Newman, and with him one of the leaders of the Oxford movement, wrote, "Of all the Pharisaisms of the day, our church-going seems to me the masterpiece." Pusey, of course, was attacking the hypocrisy of those who attended church rather in the same spirit as Lavinia, in these lines by Edward Young, written a century earlier.
"Lavinia is polite, but not profane, to church as constant as to Drury Lane. She decently in form pays heaven its due, and makes a civil visit to her pew. Her lifted fan, to give a solemn air, conceals her face, which passes for a prayer."
And let's return to the historical Pharisees. They came into existence in the 2nd century before Christ. From the Old English Pharisaos, the word can be traced back to an Aramaic one, meaning the separated, or those who have been set apart. Pharisees were distinguished by their strict observance of the traditional and written law, and, as I've read in more than one place, as having pretensions to superior sanctity. Typical Pharisees were those our Lord described as priding themselves on being virtuous and despising everyone else. What strikes one most in the description of the Pharisee who went up to the temple to pray is his attitude. He's clearly standing upright and almost certainly is at the front, whereas the tax collector, we're told, was some distance away, which suggests that he was well behind the Pharisee. The Pharisee begins his prayer by thanking God he is not like other men, or even like this tax collector. In another version, particularly not like this tax collector here. Earlier translations use the word publican, for in the Roman Empire, publicans were wealthy businessmen who managed state monopolies or farmed the taxes, which often led to abuses. So they were not popular in the provinces, and in the New Testament are often associated with sinners. So our publican in the parable is well aware that his very occupation is one for which he's held in contempt. "How like a fawning publican he looks," sneers Shylock when he sees the Merchant of Venice. So even if the publican does not know what the Pharisee is saying about him, he may well imagine it, and is even more aware that he's fallen victim to the temptations of his job. He probably feels presumptuous in entering such a holy place, and so we read, "He kept his distance." This is a very physical parable. It's not only about the words the two men use, it's about their body language. In his long poem, The Testament of Beauty, Robert Bridges writes,
"Now every emotion hath the bodily expression, beseeming each, and since the body cannot be without some attitude, so prayer will have its own. And here, just as in any athletic exercise, there be postures and motions, foolish in themselves and often undignified, so too the posture of prayer may shame our pride of spirit, which would grudge the limbs warrant of entry upon her sacred solitudes. Albeit the body come there in full abject guise to do submission and pay fealty to the soul."
And so, while the Pharisee stands with head unbowed, the tax collector does not even dare to raise his eyes to heaven. All he does is beat his breast. Today we're very self-conscious about such public manifestations of sorrow for sin. We may still beat our breasts when we recite publicly, "Through my fault, through my fault, through my most grievous fault." But it's a very half-hearted action, almost as if we were afraid of being accused of a false humility, of being like the character in Charles Dickens' David Copperfield, the unctuous Uriah Heep, described in the Dictionary of Phrase and Fable as an abject toady and a malignant hypocrite. His body language was nothing if not expressive.
He had a way of writhing when he wanted to express enthusiasm. He writhed himself quite off his stool in the excitement of his feelings. "I suppose you're quite a great lawyer," I said, after looking at him for some time.
"Me, Master Copperfield?" said Uriah. "Oh, no, I'm a very humble person."
It was no fancy of mine about his hands, I observed, for he frequently ground the palms against each other as if to squeeze them dry and warm, besides often wiping them, in a stealthy way, on his pocket handkerchief.
"I'm well aware that I'm the humblest person going," said Uriah Heep modestly, "let the other be where he may. My mother is likewise a very humble person. We live in an humble abode, Master Copperfield, but have much to be thankful for. My father's former calling was humble. He was a sexton."
When Uriah tells David he finds the Latin of the legal documents hard to understand, David offers to teach him Latin, but Uriah refuses.
"Oh, thank you, Master Copperfield," he answered, shaking his head. "I'm sure it's very kind of you to make the offer, but I'm much too humble to accept it. Indeed, you must excuse me, Master Copperfield. I'm greatly obliged, and I should like it of all things, I assure you, but I'm far too humble. There are people enough to tread upon me in my lowly state without my doing outrage to their feelings by possessing learning. Learning ain't for me. A person like myself had better not aspire. If he's to get on in life, he must get on humbly, Master Copperfield." I never saw his mouth so wide, or the creases in his cheeks so deep as when he delivered himself of these sentiments, shaking his head all the time and writhing modestly.
Uriah, of course, is a caricature, an extreme example of the falsely humble hypocrite. But in the Middle Ages, when people were less self-conscious, the humility of the publican would have seemed perfectly natural in one asking God for mercy and forgiveness of sin. Francis of Assisi took the gospel more literally than anyone has before or since. But to the men of his time, this episode recounted in the Little Flowers of St. Francis would not have seemed at all exaggerated. It's entitled, How God Spoke to St. Francis Through Brother Leo.
Once, in the beginning of the order, St. Francis was with Brother Leo in a little place where they did not have any books to use in saying the divine office. One night, when they got up to recite matins, St. Francis said to Brother Leo, Dear brother, we have no breviary with which to say matins, but so as to spend the time in praising God, I will say something, and you must answer what I tell you, and be careful not to change my words. And the very pure-hearted Brother Leo replied, with the simplicity of a dove, All right, Father, begin in the name of the Lord. Then St. Francis began to say, Oh, Brother Francis, you have done so many evil deeds and sins in the world that you deserve hell. And Brother Leo answered, God will perform so much good through you that you will go to paradise. And St. Francis said, Don't say that, Brother Leo. But when I say, Oh, Brother Francis, you've done so many wicked things against God that you deserve to be cursed by God, then you answer this way, You certainly deserve to be placed among the damned. And Brother Leo replied, All right, Father.
But every time Francis accused himself of terrible sins, Brother Leo would answer that God blessed him and would exalt and glorify him for all eternity. And when Francis protested, he would exclaim that he could not answer any other way, because God was speaking through his mouth. And so, the writer put it, they stayed up until dawn in this humble contest, with many tears and great spiritual consolations.